This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodi. Since the 1960s, there have been over 80 people's tribunals, citizens' tribunals or similar commissions of inquiry established outside formal state and international structures. These have addressed violations of international law, human rights and moral and ethical standards. And with me today is Professor Gurdial Nija Singh. He's a law professor at University of Malaya. There's going to be a People's Tribunal on GE13 that's actually in the process of being, you know, set up and on the go. So we're going to be finding out a little bit more about what this tribunal is all about. Professor, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Thank you
for coming by. Professor, why was there a need? First of all, just to go back, why is there a need for a tribunal in the first place? We know we've heard of consumer tribunals, we've heard of, you know, war crimes tribunals, but why do they even come to be in the first place?
I think when the normal state structures and formal structures do not deal with certain issues that trouble the people as a whole, then the only recourse, if you want some kind of answer mm-hmm. or solution or an understanding of a certain situation, is for the people themselves to set up a tribunal to look into those matters which are the subject matter of disquiet or concern.
Right. Is there a gap in the, you know, the justice system? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there is not a gap in the justice system as such, but certain structures in some states are set up in a manner that does not deal with those situations. Mm-hmm. And if you look at war crimes, for example, yeah. you know, you have people being charged, people from Africa, heads of state being charged. You have in Eastern European countries, heads of state being charged. But then there is no accountability for those who carry out, for example, war crimes, and they are from rich and powerful nations like the United States mm-hmm. or Britain.
Right.
So what happens in that kind of situation? There is disquiet, there is concern, there is a sense of injustice, that there is this unequal dishing out of procedures to try people. The only recourse then is people gather together and say, hey, you know, this has got to end.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to take stock and have our own people's tribunal to deal with situations like that and come to our own understanding based on scrupulously adhere to international rules of evidence and procedure.
Okay. And how effective is a people's tribunal? I mean, is it bound, you know, to the law? And is it recognized in international law?
It's not recognized in the sense that there is an enforcement machinery. But, you know, much of international law, in any event, there is no enforcement machinery. So the question is to shape people's opinions, which will then shape policies that will follow mm-hmm. from that. So it is more than merely symbolic when you look at it in the wider context, yeah. in the bigger picture.
It almost comes across as being symbolic, but the War Crimes Tribunal was actually set up by Tun Mahathir in this country. I think it took a lot to actually set up a tribunal like this. It is ongoing, and you were quite instrumental in that War Crimes Tribunal. Could you shed more light on
yes,
that?
Yes, I was chief prosecutor in two of the charges. One was against former President Bush and Prime Minister Blair
mm-hmm.
For crimes committed, crime, they call it the crime against peace, because they launched a war without Security Council authorization, which makes it an illegal war. As you know, Kofi Annan, the then Secretary General, declared and pronounced it as illegal. Then subsequent to that, there was a charge against the whole executive led by President George Bush and his advisors for the enormous, the horrendous torture and treatment that they meted out to detainees in Guantanamo, in Bagram, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan. So now, the trials were, as I said, you know, they adhered to very fair rules established by the International Criminal Court, for example. We had witnesses from Guantanamo, from Bagram, ex-detainees who told us what kind of treatment was given out. We had authorities, we had international standards that we said had been violated very flagrantly. And at the end of the day, the panel of judges who were drawn from a range of experts from throughout the world, very eminent, very respected, very neutral, and they came to the conclusion there was indeed these violations. Now, the point then is this. What happens then?
Exactly. Yeah. Both were found guilty, Bush as well as Tony Blair.
Yes.
Guilty of crimes against peace.
Yes. Now, the thing is this, that the important thing then is that these are crimes that have a universal character, which means there is no need to link the person to the country or the commission of the crime within the country. Any country is empowered to institute action against these people. This is known as universal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. It's extraterritorial. Now, this universal jurisdiction, countries can exercise. What we are now doing is approaching, there are 163 countries in the world out of about 193 of the United Nations who are entitled to exercise this universal jurisdiction. And we are in the process of eliciting the help of some of these countries on the basis of the very complete record that was initiated at the KL War Crimes Tribunal to persuade them to initiate action against these war criminals. So this is an ongoing effort. We are soliciting the aid of Garzon, who is the prosecutor, who actually got the Pinochet, who was the former head of the Chilean government. You know, he had proceedings initiated against him in the House in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And this case reached the House of Lords, where they actually pronounced that it was an extraditable offense because what he had done was a war crime, a crime against torture.
Right. And this was due to the enforcement of the universal jurisdiction?
Yes.
Okay. So one success story there.
Yes.
Do you think, because when it was set out, the War Crimes Tribunal came across as being very toothless. Would you agree?
Well, it's toothless in the sense that there is no enforcement machinery. But it's toothful, if there's such a word, right? Because it's a people's tribunal. Now, once people get convinced and aware, and we have seen this, changes begin to happen. We've seen in the Middle East how years and years of rule, autocratic rule, can be challenged by people, regardless of the structures that are set up by the powers that be at that time. So, on the one hand, it's toothless, but, you know, people's power has brought in many changes, many governments. So, I think people's power is something that has got to be given a lot of credit.
Of course. And now, of course, you're part of the People's Tribunal on GE13 to look at electoral fraud. How did this idea come to be?
I'm just involved in the that whole process involving the presentation of evidence at the People's Tribunal inquiry. It's going to be an inquiry. They have set up a legal team to investigate. There have been a huge number of complaints by people who have given their names, their telephone numbers to various observer groups during the elections. I think there is a range of something like 3,000 complaints. Mm-hmm. And there has been, because there's been a lot of disquiet, and there was an organization of 84 coalitions for free and fair elections. I think it goes under the name of Bersih, right?
Yes.
So the only way that you can deal with the disquiet or the anxiety that was expressed by the people, especially in the face of the fact that there were a lot of blogs and other information that was coming in, you know, making some of them very wild claims and some very reasonable claims, allegations, cross-allegations. I think this civil society group decided on the right thing, which is why not have a people's tribunal to sieve through all these allegations, to pick out those which have some credibility, mm-hmm. and have this presented before an eminent panel of judges who will then decide on what is wheat and what is chaff, what is accepted, what is rejected, and see whether there was an impairment of the whole democratic structure of free and fair elections.
Right. And this people are sort of encouraged to come forward and provide evidence on electoral fraud and irregularities before August 16th?
Yes. In fact,
so it's finished?
Yes. In fact, a large number of people have already provided information. Our legal team of some 30-odd lawyers, mm-hmm. can't even cope with the number of existing complaints that we have received or information that we have received.
I apologize. Is that September 16th or August 16th?
No, it's supposed to be... I think that the deadline was supposed to be August 30th, 31st or something.
Okay, yes. All right. And the tribunal is going to sit from...
On the 18th.
18th to the 22nd of September. Sorry, carry on.
So we've had a team of some 30-odd lawyers, mm-hmm. and we have gone through that information. And we, as I said, we are... making where there is credible and cogent evidence being presented, then we ask people to sign statutory declarations. Statutory declarations means that they swear that they are telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the basis upon which we are going to proceed, these statutory declarations of complainants.
Right. What do you mean by credible evidence?
Well, what we do is, for example, if someone alleges that they saw A give money to B in return for a vote,
mm-hmm.
we require more than just the say-so of the particular person. He must corroborate that evidence. He must perhaps have some kind of a video or some kind of complete evidence in relation to that. And then we assess, because these are lawyers who, as part of their professional career, they are in a position to, they continuously assess, you know, which witness can be believed, which cannot, what kind of evidence can be presented, which will be acceptable in a court of law, for example. So they make an assessment, and then we choose the persons who will become witnesses who attest to their evidence through a statutory declaration.
We're discussing the People's Tribunal on GE13. If you have a question for Professor Gudiel Nija Singh, he's a law professor at University of Malaya, who's playing quite a key role in the People's Tribunal, send us a text message. The number is 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuthi. Professor Gudiel Nija Singh, Law Professor of University of Malaya, with me. We're discussing the People's Tribunal on GE13, which is going to sit from the 18th to the 22nd of September. They've received all the complaints or allegations of fraud. I think the cutoff date was sometime in August. Lawyers have actually looked through these documents. How many have you cut it down to? I mean, how many cases now do you have that's going to happen from the 18th to the 22nd?
Oh, we have got a huge amount of evidence and complainants. But as you know, that we have to manage this. It's a 4 or 5 day sitting.
It is, which, you know, is my next question is, can you sort this all out in 5 days?
Yeah, well, we have a kind of a strategy of dealing with this. We have divided the whole categories of violations and infractions into 5 or 6 categories. One, of course, relates to the electoral roll itself, irregularities in relation to electoral roll. Then we have the question of the media, the role of the media, whether it played a fair and balanced role in promoting the democratic process. Then we have the question of money politics, the extent to which money politics did or did not undermine people's choice of candidates in an unfair and undemocratic way. Then we have actual infractions of the election laws. We have election laws in the country, you know, which says you cannot bribe, you cannot raise racist or seditious kind of campaigning material or speeches. Then we have also violations of the electoral process, how the elections are conducted. And then we deal with situations where there's abuse of power, for example, use of machinery by caretaker governments,
mm-hmm.
both in the, you know, as you know, there is also opposition governments. So we examine all that. And finally, the question of the institutional structure, which is the election commission, which is entrusted, given a constitutional mandate to carry out free and fair elections. So we have these categories. And although we got a large number of complaints, we sieve them and slot them and choose the most critical and crucial and important cases under each category. And then the rest, we will give it as a kind of a summary. So this is how we are strategizing in approaching the completion of this within the four or five days process that is given to us.
Okay. There are concerns, of course, Professor, that the allegations of fraud will be lopsided against, you know, the then ruling coalition. What are your thoughts on that?
Not really, you know, because as you know from the election petitions, the opposition Parti Keadilan, for example, I think they filed something like I can't remember exactly how many, but about 20 to 30 petitions. And the Barisan Nasional filed 21 petitions.
Okay.
So you see, there is a fairly even range of allegations against each other across the divide.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we'll be inviting as heading the legal team. The legal team has made a decision to invite all sides of the divide to come and present their versions of the infractions and irregularities and allegations of impropriety and so on. So we are hopeful. We hope that those in the Barisan, for example, do not see this as lopsided,
mm-hmm.
and that this is an attempt to do... This is a very important component in a democratic process because, you know, we have just finished an election. And civil society now wants to look at all those allegations that are being made and then give a feedback, in essence, to society at large, as well as the government, as to what went right, what went wrong, what could be improved, how could the wrong be righted, and the right be improved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an incredible process in the further democratization of our society and of our country. In fact, I have had opportunity to speak to some people who are involved in this international free and fair elections recently from overseas. And they thought, my God, if this can work really in the way in which we perceive it and hope it will work, this could be a salutary example to give to other countries, mm-hmm. which are emerging out of undemocratic regimes or trying to move towards a greater democratization. And they are going to be watching this very closely, and we are mindful of that. That's why we want to ensure that not only is this a very neutral and a very unlopsided presentation of the evidence in the inquiry, we want to make sure that it is beyond reproach, and that's our target.
What are international standards on free and fair elections?
Well, just to quickly summarize, I think they cover four or five broad areas. I think one is, of course, the institutional structure, which is whoever is entrusted to conduct elections must be independent, must conduct their activities in a transparent, even-handed way, and must be accountable, because this is a constitutional mandate that is given, for example, in Malaysia to the Election Commission. So the choice of the people must be beyond reproach. They must be people of unquestionable integrity,
mm-hmm.
right? There must be no baggage that they carry in the past or present. And then, of course, the process that they initiate must be completely transparent, must be accountable, and they must be even-handed. And they must respond to complaints in every which way. So that's very important. And then the second one is, of course, the process. The process of conducting the elections must resemble all the indicia of being free and of being fair. That's very the process. Then the substantive, that actual, the elections itself, not just the process, but there must be no inducements of any kind, no bribery, no intimidation, and so on. So the substantively also the laws must be adhered to. The election laws that are there for free and fair elections must be adhered to. And finally, there must be remedies. If someone is aggrieved that they have not been, they have been wrongly done in, either by the institutional structure or by whoever else, there must be recourse to a proper judicial independent body to seek remedies for their grievance. So these are four or five features, I think, that are very critical in the determining. These are the standards that are being set for free and fair elections.
Okay. Obviously, the standard number five is the reason why you have a people's tribunal today.
The remedies, is
yes.
it? Well, yes and no. Yes, because election petitions are filed by candidates who lose. And who lose such that the infractions would have affected the outcome. In other words, you know, something wrong has gone on, number one. And number two, if it had gone on properly, they would have it would have affected the outcome of the elections. So it's only brought in by candidates who lose. So it does not really deal with all that goes on with regard to the improprieties or irregularities of the conduct of the elections, for example. Because when we look through the plethora of complaints, you find that there are even winning candidates who complain.
Right.
But they will not file an election petition. Why would they? Because it is to declare the elections as bad, mm-hmm. and they have won. So. But those are also endemic problems that have arisen in the context of the election, which must be aired because the objective of the exercise is ultimately we want to see free and fair elections in this country being carried out. So it goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm. The People's Tribunal, is it usually a full legal entity?
Well, it's when you say legal entity, is it illegal? No, it's not illegal, mm-hmm. right?
How would you describe yourself?
Well, if civil society is entitled to engage in activities, you know, properly constituted civil society, so they then decide on this particular activity, and this particular activity is within the ambit of the constitution of the country because they're looking at a process that has been undertaken in that affects citizenry as a whole, and civil society is responsible for the citizenry, for their constituents, for example. So it is a perfectly legitimate activity. Sometimes what happens is, for example, in the KL War Crimes Tribunal, the former Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir, mm-hmm. He got together and formed an NGO, is a PGPF, Pradhana Foundation,
yes.
for peace. Right. So, and under the auspices of that, they set up the KL War Crimes Commission, and then have a KL War Crimes Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
So they are actually a properly registered society under the laws of the country, and their objective is to carry out, inquiry into war crimes committed and to prosecute those under their charter, which is recognized. And you know these activities, the KL War Crimes Commission, when they do fundraising. The Prime Minister and his wife attend. So these kind of activities which citizens take upon themselves in response to the concerns that they have either internationally, globally or locally, these are perfectly legitimate activities no matter how they are organized.
Do you have to be officially recognized in the country? The People's Tribunal on GE13?
Well, I don't think there is a kind of process for official recognition. You know, it is set up by civil society, mm. and civil society, which is legitimate, you know, there are something like 84 NGOs. They are all doing their activities,
yep.
and they all have concerns with regard to this. And they get together as a network to promote this activity. So I think that is, I don't think the issue of recognition arises at all.
Okay. You are actually going to be involved in this. How have you drawn from that experience with the War Crimes Tribunal to help you prepare for this role with the People's Tribunal on GE13?
Well, the KL War Crimes Tribunal is slightly different in character because the KL War Crimes Tribunal is prosecution. It's like the International Criminal Court. The process is the KL War Crimes Commission, one level, hears evidence, hears witnesses, and then it makes recommendations to the chief prosecutor, the prosecution team, and the chief prosecutor then draws up charges and then brings in witnesses, levies charges like a criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the charge is served on, for example, the last charge was against the State of Israel. We serve it on the Prime Minister's office in Tel Aviv. Similarly, with the when we serve Bush and Blair, they are ex-heads of state. We are entitled to serve it on their embassies because that's what the charter says. And so we follow this process quite carefully.
Mm-hmm. What will be the process for the People's Tribunal on GE13?
The process for GE13 is slightly different because it's an inquiry, which means we collect all the evidence, we present this evidence to the panel of judges. We don't allege as such that there is a fraud or infraction, but we collect all these activities under these various heads and let the panel, eminent panel of persons, the judges in fact, make a decision, an assessment. They evaluate that evidence and come to their conclusion, A, whether or not this accords with international, national, as well as regional standards of free and fair election.
Okay. Will these results be made public?
Oh, yes. That is the condition upon which we have all undertaken. This is a public exercise for public purpose that is intended to promote the democratic process. So one of the most important criteria is transparency in this whole process. And so that requires the widest possible and soonest possible delivery of the final verdict, as it were, or the assessment. And it will also have recommendations as to how, as I said, how the future should look like if you want to have an improved climate where all these 3,000 complaints either do not emerge at all after that, or they just become marginalized to a small handful of disgruntled persons. In other words, to improve the democratic process such that everybody is happy that there were indeed free and fair elections and processes in place, subjectively and objectively.
How can we be assured that the People's Tribunal on GE13, how will it be transparent and accountable? I mean, I know you've got some pretty high-profile people. I mean, the chair is Yashpal Ghai, who is a Kenyan academic in constitution and law. You just want to go through with me who the other international panel members are, who from Malaysia is sitting on the tribunal. Would you like to go through that list with me?
Yes, Yashpal Ghai has been involved and has served the United Nations in drawing up constitutions of a couple of developing countries. So he's there promoting the democratic process and acknowledged as such by the United Nations itself. So I think he's an eminent choice. Mm-hmm. And then we have Mr. Ramlan, who was formerly the head of the Election Commission in Indonesia itself. And he has a pretty steadfast reputation as a man of great integrity and fair-mindedness, neutrality, and fair judgment. So I think he would be very good. Then we have Thai. So you notice that the Yashpal Ghai is from India, of Indian origin. Mm-hmm. He's Kenya, mm-hmm. Indian origin. And then we have Ramlan from
Indonesia.
And we have Kraisak. Now, Kraisak is interesting. His father was formerly a prime minister, Prime Minister Kraisak of Thailand for a period. And he's involved in the ASEAN caucus on promoting parliamentary democracy in Myanmar. He's a very well-respected Thai in his country. Mm-hmm. He's involved in arts, culture, and all the fine things that make up a good society. So these are the three persons from overseas that are who are going to be part of the panel of judges, as it were. Then locally, we have Dato' Azad Kamaluddin. Azad Kamaluddin is formerly sat on the board of directors of the New Straits Times. He was also, I think, sat on the directorship of MAS. He's a lawyer. He was formerly in the Foreign Service of Malaysia, and he's a Cambridge graduate from Cambridge in law. So if you look at these broad credentials, you see that there are clear indications that these are that he's a man of great integrity, independence, and an understanding of media as well. Mm-hmm. And then we have Dr. Mavis Puthucherry, a former academic from my own university, University of Malaya. And she has shown a sustained interest in electoral politics, electoral processes. She, in fact, edited a book together with Dr. Nuraini, also from the university, where there was a collation of articles which looked at the 2004 elections and the way forward and so on. So she would bring considerable learning to bear upon the subject with her insight into the actual process in Malaysia itself. And
Are you not getting involved in the whole judgment process?
No, because I'm presenting the evidence.
Okay. All right.
I'm not a judge. So
yes. Okay. So you are the prosecution.
In this case, we are the presenters of the evidence.
Sure. Okay. You know, just to look forward to the future, Professor, where do you see people's tribunals coming to play? Can we do with more of them? I mean, I'm just thinking this is for free and fair elections. I'm thinking of the environment. I'm thinking of, you know, a whole lot of other issues which civil society champions and which could do with a tribunal as well.
Yes. In fact, you know, it's funny. I think there should be, as society improves and, you know, all sectors of society feel that the institutional structures are capable of looking after their interests, and as complaints, for example, subside, then there will be a withering away of the need for people's tribunal. People's tribunal arise because there are unassuaged interests and concerns. Yes, we should have a lot more, but a lot more also suggests that there are some gaps in the existing structures. But aside from that issue, I think it's also important to remember that, you know, in existing institutions and states cannot cater for the whole diversity and range of interests, given the best will in the world. So this fills an important component of the democratic process, where people's interests and concerns, and there always will be interests and concern, no matter how proactive the government is in trying to solve those problems. So this fills a gap. Now, the important thing is for the government of the day to look at it in that light, that this is an important feedback loop for the democratic process. That, I mean, you know, instead of they organizing it, somebody else is organizing a way in which they can get now a very deep insight into the nature of the complaints, the basis of the complaints, the validity of the complaints, and recommendations on how to assess. I mean, this is a freebie for the government to improve the democratic process. And if they take it in that spirit and then work on it, right, with civil society to improve it, I think this will be a real boon and an example to set for greater democratization, and we will become a great symbol of innovated, active democracy in this in the developing country, if not the world.
Yeah. Who funds initiatives like these, or is it all just done pro bono?
Well, I mean, I will be paid nothing, right? For people's tribunal, I'm not complaining, but the. I think there are enough people who come forward and, you know, come and donate. Don't forget, you know, in the first term, Obama's election, it was the ordinary citizen who picked up his phone or, you know, made that $1 contribution, which then resulted in him being one of the biggest recipients, the recipients of some of the biggest funds in the world. So, no, little people do count, you know.
Of course.
As our Malay saying goes, you know, sikit sikit jari bukit.
Yes,
see?
Correct. I think the one person we missed out on the whole...
Shastri, yes.
Yes, Reverend Dr. Herman Shastri.
Yes.
Is now, the person we missed out.
So he, of course, you know, a man of a religious, serious religious inclination. And of course, religion always, you know, talks about universal values. And so you can imagine how important it would be to have those values integrated in the decision-making process with regard to this tribunal.
Your final message, Professor Goodale?
I think, as I said, it's very important to understand what this is all about. People's Tribunal is not to is not another baton with which to whip, the government. It is an attempt to look at all the facets of complaints. You know, there are serious complaints that they've made. Let's look at these complaints seriously. Let's see which are valid, which are not valid. Let's then look at the weaknesses that emerged from this whole election. And let's look very seriously and see, are these allegations sufficient to impair the holding of free and fair elections? If they did do so, in what way did they do so? And how then can we improve on the structure and the institutional arrangement for these elections? I think we look at it constructively and people begin to participate either by listening to it, reading the reports and having debates and discussion on it, I think the country will be so much the better. This paradise will become an even greater paradise.
We look forward to those reports. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Professor Gurdial Nija Singh, Law Professor of University of Malaya, on the People's Tribunal on GE13 on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.